From Maine to Arizona, Oregon to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it is time for the conservative movement to return to the Reagan-esque optimism that is the hallmark of traditional conservatism. Tim Chapman from Advancing American Freedom is here to tell us why. Every seat in the U.S. House of Representatives will be up for election in 2026. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a look at the political landscape. President Donald Trump vowed to cut the size of the federal bureaucracy. His first year in office, he has made significant progress toward that goal. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the Pennsylvania House of Representatives has advanced a radical pro-abortion state constitutional amendment. Keith Rothfuss is here with an American Radio Journal commentary on why that violates our fundamental right to life. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. There have always been many viewpoints on what it means to be a conservative. Lately, the debate and the rhetoric have gotten quite heated. Tim Chapman is president of Advancing American Freedom. He is here to explain why we should return to the traditional values of the conservative movement. Tim, welcome to American Radio Journal.
Tim, as one who is a Ronald Reagan, William F. Buckley type conservative, I've been looking over some of the developments in the conservative movement in recent months and years with a bit of alarm. You hit on a number of those topics in a recent op-ed that you had in the Washington Examiner. What is it that you see as the areas where the conservative movement has really gone off the rails in a number of ways in recent years?
I think we are living through a very challenging time for conservatives. And that might seem a little disjointed to say when we have a Republican president and we have Republicans in charge of Congress, and there are a lot of good things happening for Republicans across the country in terms of elected office. But what I'm talking about is before elections and before legislation, and that is, what's your worldview? What do you stand for? How do you think of yourself as a conservative? And I think what's happened is there's been a trend on the right, especially over the last 4 years, to redefine what it means to be a conservative. And often what that does is you end up with different flavors of conservatism that are sprouting up, whether it's I'm a MAGA Republican, or I'm a national conservative, or I'm an isolationist conservative, or whatever flavor it is. A lot of what it all boils down to is a rejection of the kind of received wisdom from generations of conservatives who have gone before us. We want to apply public policy in a way that's even-handed, in a way that returns power to all Americans and drains power from the federal government. And I just don't see that happening right now. I see an impulse towards a more muscular and towards a more might makes right approach at the federal level. And like I alluded to earlier, I think that sets just terrible precedent. And I think the left actually will want us to do many of those things. So you have the left like very quietly cheering the idea of eliminating the filibuster in the Senate, because they know that that gives them a green light to do whatever they want if they take back power in 2028. So I think we are playing with fire here as conservatives, and I think it's time for conservatives to have a sort of a reawakening, in a sense, and to think, what is it that we can do now? And we really should lean more on Congress to do a lot of these things and put those great things in place now, but not set precedent for terrible behavior from a potential AOC presidency or a Gavin Newsom presidency or whatnot.
Certainly, right now, the instruments of government are playing in favor of conservative public policy, but there will come a time, you're correct, when the left is in power, and we're going to be trying to rein that in. Let's talk very briefly here, Tim, about populism. The populists are a key component of the current electorate with conservatives, the majority electorate that we have that's elect Donald Trump and Republican Congress. But populism, if you look at what it's supposed to be in what it started out, is it what it has now become?
When I think about populism, I want to be very careful not to be critical of populism in and of itself. I think populism, you know, Ronald Reagan was a populist. And populism can be a very good thing, but populism unmoored from principle is a very bad thing. And what I see in the populist movement on the right today is a populism that's approaching public policy and public debates much the same way that the left does. I detect a very strong hint of grievance politics within the populism of the right today. So that is to say that certain groups have been aggrieved in ways that are only able to be remedied by political punishment and by the use of political power. And again, to what I said earlier, I think that's a false form of, I wouldn't say it's a false form, that's a bad form of populism. And what I'd like to see is I'd like to see conservatives acknowledge how the left's programs have failed all sorts of different groups across this country, but apply it to a positive agenda going forward that actually lifts up all groups, not just the aggrieved groups. And I just don't think we're seeing that.
Conservatism at its very heart here, Tim, it is a forward-looking, uplifting philosophy, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely it is. It is two things. The reason it can be forward-looking and uplifting is because it also takes into account what's come before it. And it takes a long view of history and the experiences we've had as a people here in the United States. And it says what's worked, what hasn't worked. That received wisdom, again, that's an important thing. There's a great writer who's long since passed, G.K. Chesterton, who calls it the democracy of the dead. The idea that conservatives look to the giants who came before us and give them an equal vote in the future, that we look to the past and the past is equally as valid in terms of informing what can and should work and how we should approach things as the people who happen to be running around right now here and in power. And so I want to take all of the best of that, but I want to use it to apply to a program for the future. And I don't think that's where we are. I think we're in a very narcissistic and very self-centered mode right now as populist Republicans, where we think we are the only ones who have the answers. And there's no use in looking to the past. There's nothing to learn from the Reagan era. There's nothing to learn from the Buckley era. There's nothing to learn from the founding era. We have to reinvent the wheel. And that's a very progressive, liberal way of looking at the world.
We have been talking with Tim Chapman. Tim is president of Advancing American Freedom. Tim, tell us a little bit about Advancing American Freedom. Also, where can we find you on the web?
Advancing American Freedom is a think tank and advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. We advocate for principled conservative public policy in Congress and in states across the country. If folks want to visit our website, it's advancingamericanfreedom.com.
Tim Chapman of Advancing American Freedom. Tim, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Loman. Appreciate it.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As we end the year 2025 and head into the new year, 2026 is a congressional election year. Every member of the U.S. House of Representatives, a third of the U.S. Senate up for election. We're going to talk about congressional elections with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
Let us, first of all, remind our listeners where we stand in the House. Republicans have a majority, but it's been very thin, sort of bounced around a little bit over the last year or so. Where do we stand currently?
There are, of course, 435 members in the House of Representatives. We currently have two vacancies, and Republicans have a small majority, 220 Republicans, 213 Democrats. And that means the majority is only 218. You can only lose a couple of Republicans here and there before you lose your majority. We know that Marjorie Taylor Greene has made her announcement to resign from Congress early on, I think, January 5th in 2026. And so that'll bring that Republican majority even tighter, even closer to 218. And there's just a lot of really important races. We've got redistricting happening all over the country. We also know that there's been some big retirements leading to other big Republican primaries. And, you know, it's going to be competitive. So the Club for Growth and our PACs have been reviewing candidates and interviewing them and doing our research and trying to figure out who we can support in this 2026 midterm. We have one member from Arizona, Congressman Andy Biggs, who announced last January that that he was going to run for governor of Arizona. And in his district, the 5th Congressional District of Arizona, there's been sort of this competitive primary, but things are starting to take shape. President Trump and the Club for Growth PAC have both endorsed Mark Lamb, sheriff from Arizona. He also ran in 2024 in that Republican primary when Kari Lake won. And he raised a lot of money, had significant support in Arizona, and now he's running for the House of Representatives.
You reference Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has resigned from Congress. That seat will become open here in just a few days, Scott. Will Georgia, do they have special elections? How will that be filled?
The governor will have a few days to basically set what the election date is going to be. In Georgia, you've got runoff elections as well, so there should be a special election and then a primary, and those will be separated from the general election of 2026. We've already got a couple of candidates that have been testing the waters and announcing. There's a state senator named Colton Moore, who is sort of hated by the Georgia establishment. He's made his announcement that he is running. And then you've got a number of other folks that I think are kind of kicking the tires, trying to figure out if there's a lane for them. So we would still, I think, expect that race to get set for the primary date, probably in March or April, and then to have a runoff a few weeks after that. So I think we'll probably have that seat filled by the end of May. But again, it kind of depends what the governor does in setting the special election dates.
You referenced the fact there have been a number of retirements. Are there other key congressional races around the country we should be keeping an eye on?
Well, we're definitely keeping an eye on Texas. And I think that the Club for Growth PAC is getting closer and closer to making some decisions there on the candidates that we want to support. We know that there's been a number of retirements. You've got Chip Roy running for Attorney General. You have Wesley Hunt running for the U.S. Senate. You've got people like Troy Nails and Jody Arrington that announced their retirement. We know that redistricting in Texas gave us several other open seats where Republicans should have a comfortable general election. And as we navigate all these races in Houston and in Dallas area and Austin and all over Texas, I think it's just an exciting time because Texas has always had one of the more powerful congressional delegations. There's usually several committee chairmen that come from the Lone Star State. And we saw a little bit of that turnover, I think, in the 2018 election. And here we are in 2026, just 8 years later, and we're seeing another sort of changing of the guard in Texas. I think that it's going to be an important primary where people, some will avoid a runoff and save a lot of money, because with these competitive races in the Attorney General's race and also in the U.S. Senate race against John Cornyn, that's driving media market rates way up. And so it just makes it even more expensive to run these candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives. Nonetheless, I think President Trump and his team have also been investigating and researching candidates, and hopefully we'll all be on the same team together for these endorsements, and we'll get some great economic conservatives elected.
You referenced the fact that we've had a lot of redistricting, and Texas is one of those states, Scott, that did a redistricting here. The Democrats really made a focus on redistricting, gerrymandering, actually, in 2020, 2021, and were highly successful at that. Are Republicans now starting to catch up with their own redistricting efforts?
It depends on the state. Some states have completely fumbled the ball here. I think Indiana and their state Senate, they had roughly half of their guys oppose the redistricting effort for a 9-0 map that President Trump and Senator Jim Banks and the State House of Representatives, the congressional delegation, everybody supported it except for these rhinos in their state Senate. I think that President Trump and aligned groups are very interested, like the Club for Growth, in taking some of those guys out. And I think you'll also see a bunch of those state senators retire because they don't want to go out with a big loss. But we do have other opportunities. We've done well in Missouri, adding a seat. We're watching very closely in Florida to see how Governor DeSantis and the legislature approach the redistricting issue. So maybe we'll come out on top a little bit by netting a few seats, but you know, overall, it's going to be a real challenge to preserve the House majority for Republicans, and we need to make sure that the primary season elects the right conservatives that can actually win.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us about the club.
Today we talked about Club for Growth PAC. Club for Growth PAC is a membership PAC that the Club for Growth operates. And if you want to learn more about the candidates that we've endorsed for 2026, check us out at clubforgrowth.org. You can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
You're welcome.
President Donald Trump took office nearly a year ago, vowing to reduce the size of the deep state bureaucracy. On that, he has succeeded, as we learn from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
The federal government has shed more than 270,000 jobs this year, and personally, I think that's great news. Unfortunately, it's also not quite the whole story. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. And let me be the first, or maybe the last, depending on when you're listening to this, to wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays and a Happy New Year. And it has been a happy year, at least in some ways, for those of us that want to see the federal government reduced in size. When President Donald Trump took the oath of office for a second time in January, there were more than 3 million people working for the federal government. Over the 10 months since, that total has declined significantly. The newest jobs report, which was released earlier this month by the Department of Labor, shows that the number of federal employees totaled about 2.74 million in November. The total number of federal workers has dropped by 271,000 over the past 12 months, according to that same job report. And the job losses in the government sector have outpaced losses in other parts of the economy over the past 6 months. So that means that the Trump administration has nearly hit its stated goal of reducing the federal civilian workforce by 300,000 this year. That's something that administration officials had said as recently as August was the number they were trying to hit. And while the Trump administration has taken a bunch of intentional and some unprecedented steps to grow the size and scope of the federal government during its first year back in power, I think, at least by this one measure, the trend is undeniably moving in a much more promising direction. This means, of course, that we've cut about 10% of the federal workforce. 300,000 is about 10% of 3 million, which is where we started the year. So the federal workforce as a whole down about 10%, a little less than 10% in a single year. This is a noteworthy accomplishment and one that should be talked about more, quite frankly. That Trump and his team have managed to do this despite the best efforts of public sector unions and the entrenched bureaucracy and, of course, numerous lawsuits, some of which are still working their way through the federal court system. All of that makes it even more noteworthy. In fact, I went to the AFGE's website. That's one of the unions that represents federal employees to look up, and they've got an entire webpage that goes on. I scrolled and scrolled and scrolled. I'm not sure I ever got to the bottom of it, showing all of the lawsuits they have filed against the Trump administration this year, trying to stop various efforts to either roll back or reduce or otherwise prune the size of the federal workforce. There's been a lot of pushback. I don't think anybody would be surprised by that. And yet, this goal of 300,000 cuts has nearly been accomplished. That's a big deal. This pruning of the federal government was also long overdue. When the federal government crossed the 3 million employee threshold in mid-2024, that was the first time since 1994 that taxpayers had supported so many federal workers. And that doesn't count, of course, temporary surges every 10 years for the census. If you go online and you look at the number of federal employees, there's these weird spikes that happen every 10 years. That's the census. But you have to ignore those. 3 million people on the federal in the federal workforce hadn't happened since 1994. Now the federal workforce has been cut back all the way back to the size that it was in 2015, which means you can please spare me any moaning about draconian cuts, unless you think the tail end of the Obama administration was defined by a federal government that was too small, because that's the level we're at. And that means, of course, there's plenty of room to keep going. Still, the praise for Trump's cutting of the federal workforce should be tempered by three considerations. First, the number of federal employees actually matters a lot less than you probably think it does. Like, it's a nice, big, bold number. And again, I'm glad that number is getting smaller. But simply firing federal workers without shutting down or privatizing government functions generally just means that normal Americans face longer wait times when they have to encounter the federal bureaucracy, or it means that the government is spending more money on contractors and other people who technically don't count as federal workers, but might as well. In the first 2 months of the current fiscal year, the federal government spent about 1% more than it did in those same 2 months of 2024. And keep in mind, the fiscal year, because the federal government is weird, starts in October. So we're talking about October and November. Spending has actually gone up. So before cheering too loudly about the reduction in the federal workforce, let's see some cuts in spending to go along with it. How about that? That's my hope for 2026. Now, my second point is kind of related to the first, and that is that a lot of Trump's policies are actually laying the groundwork for hiring more federal workers, not fewer, or at least just kind of shifting around where federal employees work. From immigration enforcement to tariff enforcement, much of Trump's agenda requires more spending and more federal boots on the ground, and not just in Washington, D.C. His ongoing desire to snatch up portions of private companies, buying equity shares of firms like U.S. Steel and Intel, you know, that might not actually add to the federal workforce in a material way, but it certainly expands the scope of the federal government and the number of workers who might be, at least to some degree, under its control. And finally, the White House is trying to frame this decline in the federal workforce as a shift towards private sector employment. An official White House account posted on Twitter this week that the strength of the Trump economy is in the private sector, where it should be. And I mean, I agree with that. The strength of the economy should be in the private sector. But I'm not sure that story is quite true. This month's job report showed a stagnant job market across many sectors of the economy and a rising overall unemployment rate. The tariffs are a big culprit here, particularly for smaller businesses that have had a harder time absorbing the added costs from those taxes, and for manufacturing firms, which have lost 81,000 jobs this year. The only sector of the economy where jobs have been growing significantly and consistently throughout the year is in healthcare, which is, of course, largely funded by the government. Healthcare workers are not federal workers, they're not government employees, of course, but still, a big portion of the money flowing through the healthcare system certainly comes from taxpayers. So this is not quite the victory that the Trump administration wants it to be. It would be tremendous, just absolutely amazing, if federal workers were shifting from those federal jobs to more productive work in the private sector. But for now, I think Trump can only claim to have accomplished half of that goal. But hey, maybe that's still worth celebrating. Happy New Year, and let's hope for better in 2026. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of what's going on in D.C. and around the country this week at Reason.com. And I hope you'll catch me right back here next week and next year on another edition of American Radio Journal.
One of the most extreme pro-abortion state constitutional amendments recently advanced in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Keith Rothfuss has this American Radio Journal commentary on why this goes against our nation's founding principles.
The week before Christmas, a bare majority of Pennsylvania's state House of Representatives voted for an amendment to Pennsylvania's state constitution that seeks to make alienable a right that our nation's Declaration of Independence declares unalienable. It is no coincidence that this vote occurred as we neared the holiday celebrating the birth of the Prince of Peace. Now, more than ever, we need Christmas's message that God has not abandoned a fallen humanity, that he entered the world not to condemn but to save, and that he came to heal the brokenhearted and set the captives free. How did we reach a point where a majority of Pennsylvania's state representatives could abandon an express mandate of our Declaration? How could they reject what martyred statesmen like Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. taught about it? Such abandonment may stem from hearts and minds deeply wounded and pained by a past experience when they or someone they know felt all alone or believed they only had one real choice. Yet Christmas offers hope. If our legislators embraced it, they might newly appreciate the Declaration, Lincoln, and King. What exactly did the Pennsylvania House do? On December 18th, 100 Democrats and 2 Republicans voted to amend the state constitution to deny all unborn children from conception to birth their right to live. 99 Republicans and 2 Democrats oppose the effort. The proposal is extreme. It effectively bars any restrictions on abortion at all including ones based on the mother's age. This would end parental notification requirements and leave vulnerable teenagers in the hands of the abortion industry. And it is so poorly worded that abortionists would not be required to have a medical degree. Should the amendment become law, Pennsylvania would be a destination for the most extreme late-term procedures. The practices that would ensue from this amendment are not only barbaric, but they contradict our Declaration, whose 250th anniversary we celebrate next July 4th. The Declaration states that all human beings are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, foremost the right to life. Government exists, the founders wrote, to secure these rights. These words affirm life is a gift from God, not a state-granted privilege, and deny government's authority to revoke what is unalienable. Yet the Pennsylvania House seeks to do just that. Unlike these legislators, Abraham Lincoln was able to grasp the Declaration's transcendence. In 1859, he praised Thomas Jefferson for embedding in the Declaration an abstract truth applicable to all men and all times that would serve as a rebuke and stumbling block to tyranny and oppression. Lincoln viewed the Declaration as a moral standard for judging laws and political action. He warned his contemporaries, men like Stephen Douglas, John Calhoun, and Jefferson Davis, against abandoning its principles. To those tempted to deny the equal dignity of any human being, Lincoln pleaded with those who had been, quote, taught doctrines conflicted with the great landmarks of the Declaration, close quote. And he invited them to return to the truths that are in the Declaration and not to destroy that immortal emblem of humanity. Supporters of the Pennsylvania Abortion Amendment are following such conflicting doctrines and are aligning themselves with Southern Civil War-era politicians who rejected the Declaration's plain meaning. They also diverge from the 20th century's greatest civil rights icon, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King rooted his moral vision in the Declaration and in the natural law tradition. In his I Have a Dream speech, King described the Declaration and Constitution as a promissory note guaranteeing every American the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In his letter from Birmingham jail, King wrote that, quote, a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law, close quote. Moreover, King added that any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. By these standards, Pennsylvania's proposed amendment, which is out of step with the moral law and degrades the humanity and dignity of the unborn, cannot be considered just. The recent Pennsylvania House vote is not the last word, and more votes in the House and Pennsylvania Senate on this subject may lie ahead. Supporters should reconsider their position in light of our Declaration and the legacy of Lincoln and King, as well as the hope that Christmas offers. If they do not, the outlook for our Commonwealth's future is grim. I'm Keith Rothfuss for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KSAK-FM in Walnut, California, KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas, along with KCEA-FM in Redwood City, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.